Hello and welcome to Minter Dialogue, episode number 425. My name is Minter Dial and I'm your host for this podcast. Firstly, I'd like to give it a shout out and thanks for putting up a 5-star review of the show to Joe on Podchaser. This week's interview is with Dr. Marie Taillard. Marie is a French-American senior marketing academic and business leader, faculty member at the ESCP Business School, and she's also co-author with Béatrice Collin of the brand new Digital Makeover, How L'Oréal Put People First to Build a Beauty Tech Powerhouse, published by Wiley Press. In this conversation with Marie, we discuss her book and the digital transformation process that L'Oréal has undertaken over the last decade. Is it top-down or bottom-up? How will the changes and accelerated transformation posed by the pandemic stick? The role of the chief digital officer, and how to make it work in a large organization. We also look at the changes to marketing, the importance of social media, and the collaborative mindset. You'll find all the show notes on Minter Dial. Please do consider to drop in your rating and review. And don't forget to subscribe to catch all the future episodes. Now for the show. Dr. Marie Taillard, what a pleasure to have you on. You have just published with your co-author, Béatrice Collin, Digital Makeover, How L'Oréal Put People First to Build a Beauty Tech Powerhouse. I would love for you to introduce yourself. How would you like to talk to about yourself?
Oh my goodness. How do I talk about myself? I guess the best way is to say that I'm someone who loves to observe other people. I'm a social scientist at heart. I studied linguistics, so I love to listen to conversations and try to understand where people are coming from and in a figurative way, of course. So I listen to people. I try to make sense of what they say. And then I also like to, from there, develop some ideas and try to share these ideas with others. So I'm an observer and a teacher, I guess. I do coaching. I coach executives from a broad range of countries and sectors and all sorts of different people. What else do I do? I do a little bit of consulting on the side, and I love to write. So I write academic articles. Probably not enough. Wrote this book alongside my colleague Béatrice Collin. She was more on the sort of building the relationship side of things, and I did much of the writing.
Well, we share many things in common, Marie. Obviously, Franco-American, which is exactly how I describe myself, as I have those two passports as well. I also studied literature and linguistics at university and enjoy languages immensely and hopefully enjoy also and being good at observing people and the way we speak and interact and behave and all that. So lots of good stuff. On your Twitter profile, Marie, you write that you love cooking and great food. I was wondering what sort of cooking, because in the States, we talk about foodies, but I would say that the French side of me raises an eye and says,
I guess I could consider myself a foodie. I love cooking and I love eating great food. I come from a family of people who love to cook and great cooks. I had lunch yesterday with my father, who's a 90-year-old gentleman who is still an amazing cook. And whenever he comes over, I spend hours trying to put together a great meal that will impress him. And I managed to impress him again yesterday. So I'm very, very happy and very
well
proud.
Done. We do say that butter is the secret of great French cooking. Agree, disagree?
No. I don't use that much butter. I use a little bit of butter, but I'm sort of a enlightened French cook, I guess. I use a lot of olive oil, but quite a bit of it, in truth.
That's all good. So obviously, with Béatrice, who's written books before on L'Oréal, as I've seen, I haven't read any of them, so I can't profess to know anything about what she wrote about. But I was wondering, between her and you, What was the most surprising thing you discovered in your research and in your dealings, the interviews with the folks at L'Oréal in writing this book?
I mean, certainly for me, the most striking thing is how much of a transformation they were able to go through over the course of the last 10 years, on paper, but really even the last 5 years, and I'd even say over the last 2 years. I mean, one of the things, I talk about quite a bit in the book is the effect of the COVID crisis on their transformation. And that has literally just been phenomenal. And so I even today when I find out about things that are starting to, that are happening, I'm absolutely blown away by how great the transformation is. I mean, you were sharing with me a little bit earlier about, how a number of years ago they were still very French and set in their way. They're now a fully, sort of international organization where as much inspiration can, come from China. I mean, China has been a big, big part of the success story of the last 5 years, and as much as from the US or from any part of the world. So really very open to, to the different markets and to the way things are changing so fast.
Yeah, you also mentioned numerous times in the transformation, outside of the fact that you talk about digital, is this notion of diversity and inclusion, which probably wasn't the strong suit of L'Oréal, certainly in my time.
Yeah, huge emphasis. And Jean-Paul Agon, who recently left as CEO, told us many times that was what he was most proud of. And I think that the new CEO, Nicolas Hieronymus, is also very focused on this idea of diversity and really making it an inclusive organization. Inclusive, I think, in many ways, because one of the things, again, in the book is this idea of, bringing customers into the organization, bringing partners into the organization. So it becomes a real ecosystem in a way, with no clear boundaries. And that's, something we see very, very typically in a lot of organizations that go through a successful digital transformation, is this idea of the blurring of the boundaries between, the firm itself, the company, and then the people around it, whether, their customers, their suppliers, their retailers, their distributors, and so on. So you see these ecosystems that form that are absolutely fascinating to look at.
I certainly want to look at that in a moment when we talk about the blurring of the lines and the collaboration. I also wanted to get back to a point you made earlier, because I think this is a big learning for a lot of companies today. We've pretty much all had the experience of COVID, transformational at some level. And the question I have for you, Marie, is how does one ensure that it sticks? So if you're running a big company, you've had all this excitement, you figured out that actually we can work distributedly, we can collaborate, e-commerce is great, all these other things that have bubbled up and accelerated through the COVID. How do we ensure that it sticks and just so that we don't come back to the Pavlovian style, our old habits?
It's interesting, an interesting question. I think, in many ways, and it's something, that we talk about in the book several times, there is no choice. And so there's this, this momentum that keeps you going, and there's no looking back. So once you open up the doors to, what we call, co-creation with customers, consumers, and even with partners, value chain or supply chain partners, there's no closing the door. It's there. You create conversations on social media. One of the things we talk about is at the beginning of the pandemic, supply chain directors would talk about one of the executives in China who is on WhatsApp or whatever other with the people outside the company, her suppliers and so on, just to get things going. There's no changing that once it's happened. Once you start the conversations going, there's no going back. So I think it's impossible to turn the clock, and I think they realize. I mean, the results are very strong. The performance has been very strong. There's no going back. If anything, I think the acceleration that came with COVID is probably a very welcome one. And the culture also, from a sociological point of view, once people change the way they do things, once they change their practices, there's, again, no going back. So I think that momentum is really what carries them towards the future. So, and then there's at the top also, this very strong will from the top, from the CEO, who wanted to drive the digital transformation and who wanted to transform the company, the group into, and he used that expression himself, a beauty tech powerhouse. Mm.
Culture, for someone who likes to observe language and behavior, I can't help but think that the fact that we've worked remotely has a tendency to lighten the culture, or at least dilute it, because you're not sort of shaking hands, looking at the eyes, and embracing at some level, at the human level, where you can see twitching of feet or other things that indicate other parts of our emotions and the messaging. So if you're coming back to work now, and let's say in a post-COVID, whenever that's really going to happen, because gosh knows, we still don't know. But do you feel like there? I mean, if you're running a company, you can't just rely on what we did sticking, because when we come back to offices, there are old mannerisms that come back to how you come into the office and where the cafe comes in.
Yeah.
And so I'm just wondering about breaking down those type of traditions that, it's certainly in my time, were so strong.
Yeah, you know what? I'm not sure I completely agree with you on the premise that that being away from people working remotely meant, diluting the culture. Certainly didn't dilute the strength of the relationships between people. One of the things, and this isn't just L'Oréal, I mean, I find this in our own organization, in our school, and other types of relationships. People have gone through tough experiences with each other. People have had to have, very serious, difficult conversations with each other. We've seen people, obviously have COVID and deal with that. People who suffered from the emotional consequences of the pandemic. And I mean, I've had a chance to discuss it with people at L'Oréal. They went through the same thing. And I think in many ways, even though people weren't sharing offices and seeing each other on a day-to-day basis, people came closer and sort of feel closer to their colleagues and so on. There's more of a spirit of, what I call in the book, and which is one of my favorite themes, shared purpose. People really coming together to do things together, realizing that they can't do it without each other. This whole idea of interdependence in is part of shared purpose, and I think that's been very strong. And I think COVID has helped people realize that, hey, I'm part of a team, of a network, of an ecosystem, as I said earlier, that's very, very deeply, intertwined, and more than intertwined, interdependent. And so I think that when people do get back to the office, there's a certain realization of these strong emotions and this strong shared purpose that is going to be driving a lot of what happens.
It's funny, I've been listening to a couple of podcasts talking about the impact on communities after being blitzed in London. and how they returned to their old ways. There was a feeling of camaraderie during the Blitz. But when it finished, it was almost like, well, I want it back. And then things returned to some old-fashioned habits and catfighting. And that, that idea of common purpose disintegrated, or at least, you know, back to catcalling and political conniving.
Yeah, to some extent, possibly. And I can't, predict the future.
Who's to know?
I do think there's also a real, so it's, the story we tell of the digital transformation is top down and bottom up at the same time. And the two, the two forces really coming together, certainly from a top down perspective, very, very strong emphasis on collaboration, shared purpose. We talk about this simplicity program that's been sort of parallel to the digital transformation, driven from the top, but with a lot of grassroots initiatives at the same time. And I think that is taking hold. I mean, I talk to, it's interesting for me because a lot of my insights into L'Oréal come from students of mine who go work there and who report back. I've got, people who graduated a year ago, people who graduated 2 years ago, 10 years ago. And so I get, sort of this whole range of degrees of seniority there. And I'm hearing a lot of very, very positive, stories and feedback on how that is going. They really are becoming, the old silos, even the whole, you probably remember the confrontation room in Paris, right, the Paris headquarters. That's gone. And now, collaboration is the new confrontation, is one of the golden rules of the simplicity program. And that's happening.
I'm really looking at this not necessarily from an angle of how L'Oréal is going to deal with. I think of this, a lot of people listening aren't working at L'Oréal. They're running their business. They're coming back to work or not. And they're thinking, how on earth am I going to accelerate the continuing acceleration and that kind of thought? Because I really don't think it's just going to happen without intention. Because I feel like there's going to be, I personally, in the conversations I have, I see the challenge of, actually, I don't want to come back to the office. I don't want to deal with a commute. I don't want to deal with the inside politics. That was just sort of nefast, as we say in French, when you're walking down the corridors and so on. But so
nefarious,
we'll see.
Yes.
Yeah, nefarious. Thank you for that. What you talked about the shared purpose. Let's talk about that, because I've written a lot about purpose, and I think it's a fascinating topic, and it's a particularly different type of topic when you're talking about a company that has many brands. So I was wondering what your take on that shared purpose is, and how does it splinter down into someone who's working on a Maybelline or, my old brand Redken, or how do you deal with small purposes of each brand and the corporate purpose at a meta level?
Yeah, I mean, so the question for me is how do you, I would take it one step further and say, how do you deal with the purpose of each individual, member of the team? And that's actually something that I do, when I coach executives and when I do, executive programs, is to teach people how to take individual team members' own purpose, literally asking them the question, why do you get up in the morning and come to work? What is it about this job that makes you want to get up in the morning and come to work? Put aside the paycheck and so on. And from there, you're able to build a shared purpose for a team. And again, at some point, you realize, and it's a really interesting, exercise to go through, you realize that people really do buy into some sort of purpose at a larger level purpose, and then you drive it from the top at the same time, and you know, hopefully things meet because people adhere to the same values and to the same, you know, desire to do whatever, you know, they can to create value with that particular brand, that particular company. So there's a very interesting sort of exercise there of getting people to, you know, get in touch with their own purpose and actually see how it fits into the larger purpose.
Well, as you can imagine, my last book, it's all about how being yourself makes you a better leader. And in order for that to work, you actually have to know who you are and what is your internal intrinsic motivating factors and why, what motivates you in life, not to mention at work in general. Yeah, yeah. So
but getting people, you know, up and down the sort of, you know, chain, hierarchical structure to have that realization, I think is a really positive thing.
Well, and in my experience, it can be an alarming thing because you can also find out I'm not set to be here. My purpose is not here, you know, and if I haven't spent the time working on myself, I can sort of just go bully through and think, oh, it's fine and everything is lovely. But then all of a sudden you wake up and then you have your midlife crisis and whoops, things go sour.
Yeah.
So we have this idea of a common purpose. How would you describe that common purpose for L'Oréal?
Several people that I you know work with closely there talk about, you know, what seems a little cliche and certainly one of their slogans, which is, you know, beauty for all. But I think there's a real sense there of the fact that feeling beautiful inside and out is something that is really, very often the key to, you know, some level of happiness. And that to the extent that you can help people feel beautiful, you can, and more people and all people, you know, in an inclusive way, feel beautiful. That's something that's very valuable. And I really do believe that a lot of the people I work with there that I, you know, have interviewed or, you know, again, former students of mine feel that way. A sense of beauty as being not something that is, artificial or you know, but that really is the core of what makes us human.
The internal beauty.
Yeah.
So we'll talk about transformation and this idea of top down, bottom up. In your experience, Marie, if I had to, let's say, make you choose, do you think transformation has to be more top down or more bottom up?
Absolutely have to choose. You're not going to let me get away with, well, it's a combination of both.
That's the consultant's answer.
I think it's about leadership at the end of the day.
Beautiful.
So I do think that the top down is absolutely critical. Now, without the top down, you know, critical. But you need to get the grassroots going too.
Of course, but, especially at that size, you know.
Absolutely. I mean, and, you know, again, I talk about it, you know, at length in the book, Jean-Paul Agon's, real sort of, vision and realization early on of what was going to happen is absolutely the key. But then also the fact that he accepted, a lot of ambiguity around that realization. He wasn't sure how it was all going to happen. And then bringing in, a really highly talented chief digital officer, Lugo Mira-Rocher, was also, a key element of the success.
So one of the things as I read it, when you talk about Jean-Paul Agon's identifying the need for transformation and calling it early, I have to say, that I didn't consider it early when I was there. And when since I come from the United States, as you know, there was, I think the United States was much earlier than France in the transformation. So I was wondering whether you considered that early on a more European level, as opposed to a worldwide level, Because certainly if you look at just finished the Ford and General Motors in 2009, they were spending 25% of their marketing budget on digital, which was far from the case at L'Oreal in 2009.
Okay, so a couple things here. The first thing is, I don't know that it's Europe versus the US, because I think at the end of the day, it was sector by sector, and they were they weren't late, certainly, let me put it this way, in terms of the beauty sector. First thing. The second thing is what you describe at GM and so on, putting budgets into digital marketing is not digital transformation, right? Digital transformation is much deeper. It's, you know, things like, you know, becoming, you know, customer-centric. It's changing the culture and so on. And so, I mean, L'Oreal was putting money into digital marketing, you know, early on. But that's not, you know, what I would call digital transformation. And that's, you know, that's kind of the theme of the book, is to say, hey, you know, yes, there are a number of different markers, digital marketing, you know, having, you know, the systems, behind your operations and your, et cetera, but it is also about a people transformation. And I would even argue it is primarily about a people transformation, about that human transformation.
And you can imagine, I totally applaud that thought. So again, going back to the idea of the top down, one of the things that I've observed is this idea of the chief digital officer. And I, sometimes I would just raise my eyebrow about, for example, the nominating a person of color to run the diversity, or a woman to run equality. It's and then if you need to identify a chief of that thing, of course, it identifies that we have an issue. How do you make a chief digital officer successful in their mission? I mean, obviously, Rocher Lubomira did a great job, a really talented individual who's now gone on to doing another great job. How does one accommodate and make that successful? Because if you come into an environment where digital hasn't happened and transformation has not happened, you've got a lot of rowing to do upstream.
I think a number of things. What made her succeed? I think the first thing is that she did have, you know, a really good understanding of what was at stake and where things were going. She's a very smart woman. She really understood the underlying drivers of digital transformation. And the first and foremost, this whole idea of customer centricity. I also think she's someone who got the culture very, very quickly. She spent some time, you know, sort of listening and watching.
Being L'Orealized.
Exactly.
Right. Exactly. L'Orealization.
She really got it pretty quickly. I think she is someone who's a great she understands change management and what it takes to bring people on board, and she is also someone who's extremely charismatic, and so she was able to get her message across. And to get people to be enthusiastic when they listen to her and get on board and want to get on board and want to do well, you know, by working with her. She's very charismatic and makes you want to get on board. And so I think all of these different things, I mean, she had, you know, she totally got it. She knew how to, you know, where she needed to take things. She had a good sense of change management. How do you drive change in an organization, you know, that's 100 years old and that has a very strong culture. And she was able to make it happen because people like her.
It's such a challenging job. I've spoken to many chief digital officers, and very much the issue at some level is that digital touches everything: operations, marketing, human resources, finances. I mean, everything is included. Yeah. So you kind of have to be a jack of all trades as you try to drive that. And that must be really adds to the challenge.
Yeah. It's a general management job, no question about it. And interestingly, she didn't, you know, she was a consultant. She didn't have that general management experience. But again, I mean, she's a pretty bright lady. So she was able to make it happen. Now, she also got a lot of support from, you know, from Jean-Paul Agon and from the board. The fact that she was made, you know, that she sat on the executive committee, I think gave her a lot of obviously clout and support and sense of, you know, I can make this happen. She had excellent teams. I mean, a lot of the people we, you know, interviewed for the book, again, are very smart people who got it. And so, yeah, no, it's definitely a general management job, you know, and then some.
Yeah, not only you have to have charisma, but then you have to gain the confidences of the big unit managers who are very operational, have been doing that for a long time. And who are you to tell me what to do? And that's a true challenge.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the other thing about her, and you know, I write about it in the book, is she, you know, she's originally from Bulgaria and spent some of her childhood in North Africa, and so she's an immigrant in a way, and she has that real sort of resilience. And this sense of, you know, I want to make things happen, that, you know, that often comes with people who've had a very sort of multicultural upbringing and probably, you know, not always been part of the, you know, sort of
the elite.
Exactly. And so I think that's also quite remarkable. It's something she's, you know, she's told me that she's very, very proud of also.
It reminds me a little bit like a rabbit hole about how when I was working at L'Oréal, I would often try to find women in Asia to take on senior roles because they by definition brought diversity into the equation, and B, and of course these are generalizations, so I'm in tricky waters as a white male, but they had a need to prove. And somehow in at the time a far more masculine environment, that sort of that hunger that you're talking about, the immigrant hunger, is a fascinating position of strength. If I've been through shit and now I'm in a job, I can handle this. A little problem here and there, not a big deal.
And actually, Lubomira's replacement is a woman from India. Who's been at the company for a number of years, but so a true L'Oréalian, but you know, certainly bringing a different you know, sort of cultural element to the equation.
Yeah, I talked with a senior executive at L'Oréal, Vismay Sharma, recently about the Indian culture as well, and I think there's a real key to successful leadership if you can dissect the Indian way. So there's so many other topics I want to cover, but one of them you talk about the domain of marketing. Mm-hmm. At some levels, some people would say L'Oréal is a school of marketing.
Absolutely.
There are others who would say, well, it's actually a financial company when you look at the number of acquisitions they do and how rigorous they are with regard to the P&L. Talk us through this, how they've had to adapt, because obviously marketing, a little bit like the CDO, is sort of a general position. Marketing involves so many more things than the old days of just going down to Publicis and getting a two-page spread in Vogue. We're now in such a multifarious social. So talk us through a little bit the learnings that you picked out that other companies could benefit from in thinking about how they transform their marketing.
So I guess you know, the expression that's used at L'Oréal is precision marketing, right? And that's really that it sort of encapsulates, I think, what marketing has to become, you know, for a company that's you know, transforming itself. It's the idea of bringing together data-driven decision making. Data-driven, actions and buying and advertising and you know, social marketing and so on, and then the creative side. So it's sort of this blend of the very, very rigorous data-driven everything has to be measured. You know, you have, you know, a total, you know, visibility on the ROI of every, you know, last euro that you spend. And at the same time, you're thinking in an incredibly creative way about, you know, how are we going to, you know, bring, you know, this influencer into, you know, our mix? How are we going to, you know, do more, you know, sort of social commerce using different media, different networks and so on. So it's that blend that is particularly powerful and which I think, you know, they are getting. They certainly seem to be getting right. So they've built, you know, this incredibly powerful, you know, machine, you know, that collects data and then, you know, processes it and then gives them, you know, again, in real time, a sense of how well they're doing with what they're able to optimize, you know, constantly in terms of their buys and in terms of their, you know, how, you know, what media and so on they use, and at the same time constantly coming up with new ideas of how do we make this more relevant to you know, to our customers.
It very much invokes the old saying, I suppose, old because that was from my time, of being part poet, part peasant.
Absolutely, yeah.
The creative spirit, but the hardworking, getting that data that you talk about. And let's go into the data story, because you mentioned, of course, we talk about the beauty tech powerhouse or the tech beauty powerhouse. Artificial, you talk about AR, VR. Artificial intelligence is of particular interest to me when we start talking about data, because, of course, you also talk about the challenge of data privacy, GDPR, and managing that. But I also have recollections of how difficult, you know, and with a lot of companies I've worked with since leaving L'Oréal, on how difficult it is to somehow have the ownership of the data be everybody's. Because, for example, you know, I run a country, and this is my data and my consumers. Of course, the consumer leaves Rio de Janeiro and flies into Paris, and some of the luxury companies have particularly had challenges, you know, sharing consumers like this for many reasons, because the P&Ls are generally run through the countries. So I was wondering what your experience was, or what you learned, what are good ideas for allowing for the data to be more shareable? Because if you don't have good data, then you have bad AI, right? It's bad data, bad AI.
I mean, again, this is it's a question of you know, top down and bottom up. So there are systems that are driven from the top. And you know, that enable both the harmonization of the data. And again, one thing I should say is I'm not a data specialist. So this
well,
is
you and I are linguists. You and I are linguists, right?
Right,
you
know, exactly. My understanding is you need you know, very, very strong you know, systems that are group wide you know, you're driving this from the top. At the same time, as you know, a lot of the ideas of what kind of data can we collect and how are we going to make it, you know, use it in the most relevant way, that's coming, you know, from local markets, from a brand. You know, there's a lot in there, and we discuss it in the book, that comes from some of the newer acquisitions, some of the, you know, West Coast, US West Coast based acquisition, you know, Nix and so on, where they had excellent practices, and in a way they were brought in, you know, so that the group could you know, grab these practices. So a lot of these, you know, sort of local experiments and practices get picked up and get you know, shared and disseminated around the company. But you need the systems and the standards at the top and the will at the top to tell people that, hey, you know, this is the way it's going to be shared. Yeah. So it's an interesting, and again, this is something that required someone coming in and saying, okay, we're going to play nice, right? We're going to make this happen together. And there's so much that we can gain by, you know, by working on this stuff together. AI, I mean, the great success story in terms of AI is Modiface, the acquisition of Modiface, that enables them to develop, virtual try-on and, all this great stuff that is now giving them a real, functions as a real asset when it comes to their relationships with, the marketplaces and the Amazons of the world and China as well with the big players, because this is something that's very desirable to a lot of these retailers, online retailers, is the ability to offer virtual try-on and a lot of the stuff that's associated with that. So it gives them leverage and allows them to build healthier relationships, let's say, healthier partnerships.
Yeah, I was very intrigued about that, sort of opening up to the externals. And what one of the things that really struck me, Marie, was the rate of acquisitions. Clearly, most brands in L'Oréal at some level have been purchased. There are a few that are still homegrown. Yeah. But I was looking, I counted, there are 46 acquisitions that they've made since 1928, 24 of them, so more than half, since 2010. And whereas L'Oréal used to be much more about homegrown personnel, you are sort of, I think, hinting at this idea of acquiring talent, so acqui-hire kind of concept, which means not only Lubomira or Che, but also the nice, let's all be nice. I love that little double entendre.
Yeah, yeah.
Bringing in external employees with the acquisition helps also bring in understanding of what digital is all about and this transformation that's needed.
Absolutely. But, you find that today in so many organizations that are doing a great job with their digital transformation. It is about creating these ecosystems and bringing in not just the people, but the knowledge, the practices, the culture, right? And all these things that help transform. One of the interesting things around the time that they acquired NYX, and I don't remember the detail exactly of who said to some of the marketing executives who were looking at the NYX model, hey guys, let's make sure that we don't kill the model. Let's embrace it and bring it in, as opposed to trying to turn them into, what we know how to do. So real desire there to learn from the ecosystem.
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt that the challenge of a strong culture like that is to shift culture. And that risk when you bring in a small company of scrambling them and just imposing your way. So last year I wanted to chat with about social media. You talk about there's at least one chapter, I think it's called Becoming Social. And
I call it social centricity, right? They turn themselves into a socially centric organization, which I find fascinating.
Yeah, and you talk a lot about how they have now, along with collaboration, integrated the politeness of the heart and empathy, which was the topic of my last book. So I'm, obviously quite involved in that thought. One of the areas that's interesting, so you talk about obviously working with beauty influencers who, are sharing and pushing trends and so on and so forth. The area that interests me as a former executive is the role or position of executives online themselves. Mm-hmm. And what observations do you have about how an executive who has to do meetings and get business in and all these other things should or not be on social media?
Yeah, interesting. I actually believe that it's becoming a must. I mean, there's no way around it. And you see some of the more, woke executives these days who are very, very authentic and transparent, in terms of their online, personality. And I've noticed just in the past few weeks that the new CEO, Nicolas Hieronymus, is actually, has his own accounts and is sharing stuff in a much more, certainly transparent and authentic way than his predecessor. There's obviously a question of generations there also. But I do think that, these are people who need to cultivate, their own brand in order to have that, cultivate that charisma that we talk about, that's so important to these, transformations and so on. And then, of course, there's all the other stakeholders out there. There's, consumers, there's the media, there's, distributors. So they definitely benefit, from that. One of the people that I follow, or had been following very, very closely, an executive, was the CEO of Danone, who was recently ousted, and he had and continues to have a very, very strong social media presence, and I think has been so, is it a success story or not, but I think he's been able to at least influence public opinion. I think Emmanuel Faber is the name, has been able to influence public opinion through social media. So I do think it's become pretty critical.
Yeah, and it goes back to this jumbling challenge of, I say jumbling as in which word you lead it, up, top, down, bottom, up. You have a corporate purpose, you have brands, you have voices of each brand, you have voices of each executive, and that is, one circus of animals to try to herd through and get through. Marie, it's been a pleasure having you on this. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Well, thank you, Mentor. Thanks for a great conversation.
How can someone follow you, track you down, get your book, of course?
Uh-huh. Well, the book is on Amazon, I think pretty much in it's still only in English, but we're looking forward to translations into other languages. It's available on Amazon through book retailers around the world. As far as following me, I'm on LinkedIn, Marie Taillard. I'm on Twitter, Marie Taillard. I have a page on website of my school, ESCP Business School. I do respond to nice emails. Sometimes it takes a while, but emails, certainly through LinkedIn and Twitter, very, very happy to connect with people.
I'm thinking it's time to go. Marie, it's been a pleasure having you on. Thanks again for that. Good luck with finishing school and the transformation that you have there. And of course, the next challenge of a beautiful meal for your father.
Thanks, Mentor. That's very kind. Take care. Thanks for your time.
Thanks for having listened to this recording of the Mentor Dialogue Show. You'll find the show notes and other blog posts on mentordial.com. If you enjoyed the show, please head over to iTunes to give a rating and review. And to finish, here's a song I wrote with Stephanie Singer, A Convinced Man. Lying. I'm a convinced
struggle to see. Live for the challenge, so life's not incomplete. What's wrong with challenge? I know soon we all die. I like the feel of a stranger tucked around me, precipitating the danger to feel free. Trust in my reason and let me show you why. I'm a convinced man, practicing my lines. I'm a convinced man, here in these confines. A convinced man, in the arms of a woman. I'm a convinced man, bit to the test. I'm a convinced man.
My name is Cindy Burnett, and each week I interview at least two traditionally published authors on my podcast, Thoughts from a Page. We talk spoiler-free about their books, so you can listen whether you have read the book or not. And then we delve into things that you most likely won't hear about anywhere else. The importance of the cover design, why they included various aspects of the story, personal details about both the books and the authors' lives, and so much more. You can find the podcast on every major platform and learn more about it on my website, thoughtsfromapage.com. Thanks so much for checking it out.